Talk given Friday, 8th September 1972. I think we can all agree that we are living under a cloud which becomes darker and darker as the months pass by. You probably have guessed what is in my mind. This murderous violence which took place in Munich at the Olympic Games. We know that it goes on everywhere in the world now. Goes on in the name of peace, in the name of rights, in the name of all that we hold as values by which to live. And the method chosen is the method of death. An extraordinarily cynical reflection upon man's passion to live as he wishes, instead of trying to live in the light of some understanding of what it means to be a human being. Where does all this violence originate? Is it due to the pressure of conditions, of circumstance? Is it only due to the fact that human beings, and large numbers of them in some parts of the world, are deprived of their legitimate rights and so forth? Is it only due to that? Or are there some deeper springs of violence in the world as a whole, not only in the human race, which produces this misery, this horror, this mounting horror which will engulf the race before the century is out in a horrible Holocaust? Do think about this deeply. Do feel it very sensitively. Our concern is the religious life. But the religious life does not mean that it is a life just for us as separate individuals. We cannot cut ourselves off from the whole. And it is precisely this which has lain at the root of man's mistakes and follies and horrible deeds. This ignorance of the unity of the whole species, the human species, as well as the thoughtless, callous refusal to look into it deeply by all human beings, is, as far as I can see, perhaps the most powerful cause of all the violence that goes on around. Now, if we really mean business as far as living the religious life is concerned, we have no option but to be exemplars of the realization of this unity. This realization is not a matter merely of accepting the idea. It is not a matter of engaging in this, that, and the other, not only a matter of engaging in this, that, and the other worldly activity which seeks to promote human brotherhood. There are other forces, deeper and extraordinarily powerful, lying within our own selves, as well as lying within the human race as a whole, which we must understand, and understand so completely, so profoundly, that we become centers of peace. There is no other way. Now, in this connection, recall some of our considerations, especially since last November, regarding the nature of the psyche and the way that forces enter into and emanate out of the psyche. First of all, we must realize that whilst it is convenient to talk in terms of each person's psyche, and it is true that each person's psyche has a reality of its own, it distinguishes that person from other persons, there is this universal psyche of the human race as such. Our psyches interpenetrate. They continuously influence each other. What does that mean in actual terms? Any thought I think, any feeling I feel is not exclusive to me. It is not exclusively my thought or feeling. The psychical energy which expresses itself through me, the person, in the particular form which makes me say, oh, I think, or this is my thought, or I feel, or this is my feeling, this psychical energy is a universal thing. It belongs to the whole human race. If 10 other people, if 1,000 other people are in a rage, that rage is invading what I commonly call my psyche, and I can't shut the doors against it. This is something we must realize. This is one of the great mistakes the human race has made throughout the ages, to try to shut the doors of the mind and the heart to all the influences that come to us. It is a futile effort. We cannot do it. We have to be sensitive. It. We have to take full cognizance of it. If not, that wave which comes from thousands of other people to us overwhelms us, catches us up, and produces reactions which are no wiser, no kindlier than the forces of violence and stupidity which have invaded our psyche. You see, I have again and again mentioned the physical, a physical analogy here, the air we breathe. What air am I breathing? The same air as you are breathing. And I breathe out, just as you breathe out, that very air. And it is all mixed up. We can't say, no, this is John's air and that is Mary's air, and so forth. And isolate it. We cannot isolate it. If we can't isolate something which is actually physical and material, how can we isolate that which is even subtler and more more easily universally spread than air? And that is thought, feeling. It's a real force, a real energy. So the question arises, how do we deal with this business? Recall again that we tried to see that one's own psyche, again a convenient phrase only, that one's own psyche is the receptacle of what we call in India karma, all the karmic energies and forces, those which come to us, those which go out from us. Now we can't say nay to whatsoever comes to us, as I've already said. We cannot say no to it. In fact, I go further and say we have to be fully sensitive to it and fully awake to it, see exactly what is coming and not shut our eyes to it. Now, inside ourselves, in the ordinary way, a reaction emerges. This is where oneself, the individual, comes in. Yes. Now, this is where we as individuals come in. If we are concerned with living the religious life, we have to remain so wide awake, so balanced inside, not repressed, not suppressed, but so balanced inside and so perceptive that there is no inevitable reaction of anger, violence, and so forth in our own psyche. Because we inject that into the world atmosphere. And this is a very difficult task, but this is one of the most important tasks of the religia. This is how we work out karma, as the phrase goes, in the right way. Otherwise, we are merely pawns in a game. And we are pawns on the side of the forces of destruction and evil. Now, note very carefully, it is not that we fight against evil. If we fight against evil, we are still enclosed in the dualistic realm. It is a state of war. We have to cease from all fighting. Because fighting, opposing, trying to impose our particular view upon things is not the way of creative renewal. It is not the way of transformation of the ill into the good. This is something which is hard to see, really hard to see. Therefore, remain so widely awake that no reaction of anger or ill will or malevolence or hate or the desire that the evildoer shall be punished, receive his deserts and so forth. Those are all forces of hatred. And it is so easy to delude ourselves that our anger is a righteous anger, a righteous indignation, that it rises up in defense of honor, justice, freedom. It rises up in defense of honor, justice, and freedom as defined by me. And that definition, in the ultimate analysis, is always a self-centered definition. Because, think, if I were a member of the opposite party, I would be saying the same things, wouldn't I? And who is to decide where is the right? We can't decide where is the right. But if we are truly unselfed, then the right will naturally, spontaneously be there. And if the mind is pure, that rightness will light up in the pure mind and show us what is the course of action for us. To live the holy life is a far more tremendous achievement, if I may use that word, than doing anything else successfully in the sphere of duality. Let us not think that this violence and so forth is special to our age. Let me read to you what went on in the time of the Buddha. These are punishments which are meted out to a robber or an adulterer. They flog him, or they cut off his hand, his foot, or his hand and foot, his ear, nose, or ear and nose. They torture him with what is called the gruel pot. That is, they take off the top of the skull and, taking a red-hot iron ball with pincers, drop it in so that the brain's boiled over. Remember, this is in the time of the Buddha, which is just about a century later than the golden age of the supreme insights of the Upanishadic teachers. It is an extraordinary situation, isn't it? We have a counterpart of that in the time of Jesus. The horrible things that were perpetrated by man upon man at a time when a Jesus, a Philo Julius, and mighty spiritual beings like him flourished. They torture him with the chank shave, as it is called. And this was sandpapering the scalp with gravel till it was smooth as a seashell. There are several other things described here, but I won't harrow you with a detailed recital of it. What is important for us is to awake to the fact that there has hardly been a period in human history when man perpetrated incredible atrocities upon his fellow man. Now, let us look at what the Buddha taught in order to deal with this. He pointed out, more by implication than explicitly, that within ourselves lie all these forces. If we look at our own feelings and thoughts, when we hear the news, when something happens to us, when there is any provocation, we will have to admit that we are quite capable of all the evil that we see the so-called actual evildoer perform. And it bubbles up inside our feelings violently, wildly, madly. Then perhaps we calm down and say and wonder, good heavens, surely I couldn't do that kind of thing, could I? But that's too late, because I have done it in my feeling and thought already. Recall Jesus' statement, he that looketh after a woman with lust hath already committed adultery in his heart. Look at the teachings as regards the simple moralities in Hindu and Buddhist teachings. Give you one example. In the Shandilya Upanishad, the simple moralities, which are the indispensable basis for the whole discipline of yoga, starts off with the statement, in thought and word and deed, let there be complete refraining from all harming. Let there be complete truthfulness. Let there be kindliness, continence, charity, firmness of mind under conditions which are painful or pleasant. In thought and word and deed. Now there we have, if I may use such a military phrase, our marching orders as regards living the pure life. And in the course of living that sort of life, here is something which is extraordinarily significant. A person who lived in the forest seeking spiritual wisdom. His name was Kassapa. He visited the Venerable Bakula, who was one of the bhikkhus of the Buddha, one of the old ones. "How long is it since you, Reverend Bakula, went forth," that is, left the home life for the homeless life? "It must be 80 years, friend, since I went forth." I must interpose a little personal remark here. There must be some mistake as regards the 80 years. This going forth, which was instituted by the Buddha, was instituted when he was 35. He himself only lived up to 80. How could Bakula have gone forth as a follower of the Buddha for 80 years? Unless the going forth was a practice which was not exclusively to the followers of the Buddha, but was practiced by other teachers and their disciples also. That is a possible explanation. And then later on, Bakula may have taken to the Buddha's fold. That is the only possible explanation. Now, I mention this because, you know, we have a way of reading the texts and just reading them blindly. No, read them critically. That is to say, with eyes completely open, attending to what is there, so that it passes the bar of reason successfully. This is very important. All right. "And how many times during those 80 years have you, Reverend Bakula, indulged in sexual intercourse? Friend Kassapa, you should not question me thus, but you could question me thus. And how many times during these 80 years, Reverend Bakula, did perceptions of sensual pleasure rise in you?" If you examine that very carefully, you will see how much more inclusive, how much profounder and psychologically sounder is that question, the way that question is phrased. You see, because it takes you to the heart of the matter, the psyche, the actual physical expression of it is only the end point. It is not the wellspring of sensuality. The wellspring is in the psyche. So, did perceptions of sensual pleasure, and it includes all the pleasures of the senses, that phrase. "During the 80 years that I have gone forth, friend Kassapa, I am not aware of any perception of sensual pleasure rising in me." Then again he goes on, "During the 80 years that I have gone forth, I am not aware of any perception of malevolence or perception of harming rising in me." How many of us could say something remotely approximating to this state? "I am not aware of any thought of sensual pleasure, thought of malevolence, or any thought of harming arising in me." And so on, he goes on. The observing of the simple moralities, which mean that here was a person whose psyche was pure, utterly pure. Not to be shaken, not to be perturbed, upset by all the tides of psychical evil which flow in upon us every day of our lives. No reaction of any sort of evil arose in this monk. Now, bear in mind that the Buddha was so well aware of all the cruelties and horrible things that were done in his day in the name of justice, to punish the robber, the adulterer, the murderer, and so forth. Now here is a discourse in which the Buddha ends up by talking about loving kindness and generally speaking about love. Herein, monks, you should train yourselves thus. Neither will our minds become perverted, nor will we utter an evil speech, but kindly and compassionate will we dwell, with a mind of friendliness, void of hatred, and we will dwell having suffused that man who spoke unkindly or harshly or rudely, etc., to us. We will dwell having suffused the whole world with a mind, far-reaching mind of friendliness, that is, far-reaching, widespread, immeasurable, without enmity, without malevolence. This is how you must train yourselves, monks. Now, listen. Monks, even if low-down thieves might carve one limb from another with a double-handled saw, yet even then, whoever sets his mind at enmity, he, for this reason, is not a doer of my teaching. See, we must really be tremendously sensitive to the immensity of this and its significance. If we are sensitive, then we will wake up to the potency of the individual psyche, which will never react with violence or hate, but will in fact be always full of loving kindness, of compassion. You see, this is how love becomes an absolute value, a spiritual power, and does not remain in that petty, dualistic, ambivalent realm of the love-hate seesaw. See, what, as long as we are capable of hate, And we are capable of hate essentially because we are self-oriented and self-centered. As long as we are like that, our love is only a possessive thing. It is a sensuous thing. It is not this transcendent power, this absolute reality of this unknown energy which is pure mind, or call it divine power, or use any phrase you like, but which the brain will not know and cannot, it cannot know. But that is the transcendent value, which is love. And that emerges when our own mind, our own psyche, is free of any reaction, but is always full of this loving kindness and this friendliness, this compassion, which is void of hatred, which is far-reaching, widespread, immeasurable, without enmity, without malevolence. We constantly ask for some system of discipline. We think in terms of the steps on the path to perfection. But we must start by first divesting our minds of this dark cloud of self-centeredness. What is this perfection which I seek? It is for myself, isn't it? I want to escape my troubles, my sorrows, my difficulties. I want solutions for my problems, and so forth. It's so difficult to break this shell of selfness. But until we have really burst through this shell of selfness, we as men can never come into being. We shall always remain subhuman inside the shell. When we have broken through this shell, then at last we have entered our own proper kingdom, the human state. And the human state is the one in which the transcendent values, love, wisdom, goodness, purity, free of all dualistic conflict, express themselves naturally, spontaneously, as a matter of course, in our everyday life. It is this which can heal humanity. We can't say in this instance that, I must get well and strong myself first, then I'll go and help the others. You see, if I say that, it means that my consciousness at root is still isolatively self-conscious. I must really see the fact that the only real meaning to thinking that if I am whole and well, then all the world can be made whole and well. This idea holds good only if I am free of the consciousness of being separate, unrelated. Then you see, there'll be no seeking either for the other fellow or the community or the world on the one hand, or for me on the other hand. This fundamental delusion of which makes us think and live in terms of thou and I, this fundamental delusion goes out. It is as if a tumor in the soul has at last been removed. A poisonous tumor in the soul has been removed. There is another discourse in which the Buddha speaks to three of his disciples who are living by themselves, living the holy life. And you know how the Buddha and his disciples always observed the courtesies. It's one of the very charming things about all these accounts. Never in a discourse do you find the statement, and then so and so came into the presence of the Blessed One and sort of straight away plunged into a discussion. Oh no, they both exchanged the greetings and compliments of politeness and courtesy. And the Buddha always asks his bhikkhus, how are you getting on? Are you all right? For alms food, for your robes, and for a place to take shelter in the rainy season. He always asks that. You see, there is no sort of airy-fairy otherworldliness about it. He is down to earth, matter of fact. Here is this disciple. Is he all right? Has he enough food? Has he shelter? Has he clothing? No one can say he wasn't a first-class socialist. Or shall we put it another way, and a better way? That he had the true social sense. He cared for society, for man, his brother man. Now when he visits these three, Anuruddha, Nandiya, and Kimbila, those were the three. Having asked the preliminary questions, he asked them, and are you able to carry on the discipline living in harmony, regarding each other with the eye of affection, like milk and water blending? Now, think of this. Feel this out. Like milk and water blending. Regarding each other with the eye of affection. And Anuruddha, who is the elder of the three, the eldest of the three, he answers for all, actually. But the others also say the same thing after Anuruddha has said it. And he says, yes, Lord, we do live like this, regarding each other with the eye of affection and living like milk and water blending. And the Buddha asks him, and how do you manage to do that? And Anuruddha says, I'm just giving the gist of it, I put aside what is in my own mind, and consider the others all the time.
And each one of them does precisely that. With respect to the other two. No I-ness and thou-ness. No mine or thine. There is a unity, a natural unity, to which each one of them is fully awake. You see the implications? In the disciplinary rules of the order, the Buddha says to the bhikkhus, if your preceptor or your pupil is ill, you must attend to him personally and never leave him. He has no father or mother to look after him. He is your responsibility. You must give up your own period of meditation, etc., etc., in order to look after the one who is suffering. And he says, whosoever has done that unto any bhikkhu has done it unto me. Reminds you of the words of Jesus, don't it? 5 centuries later. Now, we here today, in our 20th century, which is working up towards such a horrible climax of violence and the evil things, definitely the evil things, make no mistake about it. How are we facing this situation? You see, the discipline, the whole discipline, has this single root: to be free of isolative self-consciousness, to be constantly wide awake to oneself and to the total environment. To observe all that is happening. And then there is the growth of understanding and love. It just emerges naturally, unobstructed by the psyche, which becomes a prison house because of isolative self-consciousness. And then nice phrases like one total reality or the unity of life and all mankind, we are brothers and all the rest of it. Oh, it's so easy to talk about it or to sing about it quite lustily. When we form part of the choir or whatever it is of the 9th Symphony of Beethoven, O ye millions, I embrace you. Do I ever embrace, leave the millions, do I embrace even one? Wholly and completely. Meaning that no feeling of anger or impatience or anything goes out towards the person. This is the embracing of mankind in your heart. You remember that earth meditation we have sometimes practiced? I mean, just gone through here. But what we have gone through here is an external ritual, after all. I mean, we just close our eyes, sit quietly. I say certain words and you try to follow it in thought. But when you are by yourself, and that doesn't necessarily mean in the absence of others, you can be wholly yourself. The plenitude of your aloneness can function fully here and now in the midst of others. You see? Or when you happen to be alone and there are no other human beings about, you are in a quiet room or maybe in some wood or woodland or whatever it is. When you are by yourself, and if you enter into this state and enter into it with intensity, real intensity, don't let it become just an emotional wallow in the brotherhood of man or the oneness of humanity. Not an emotional wallow, but a real intense awakening to the fact of it in your inner consciousness. And then you'll be sensitive to all that mankind does. And in that state, watch yourself. Not condescending pity. Not superior hatefulness. I am better than thou. I don't do such things. If you do them, that is the same as my having done them. And if I do them, it is the same as you having done them. You see, this thou-I separation has to be out. And if in our inner awareness we are to grow into this realization in completeness, then we must transcend all the limitations that our senses and the indulgence of the senses, our cultural abilities and so forth, which demand expression, we must transcend the whole lot of them. We must transcend all our beliefs, our ideas, our aspirations, however sublime they may be. We must see that they are all just passing shapes, and most of them are just at best charming little illusions. Those must go. And then the reality, the unknown reality, this thing which is divine, which is true perfection, which is God, if you like, comes to fruition through me, who has ceased to be a separate me.